Welcome to the Illusion of More podcast. I'm David Newhoff. As most people know, we are this week watching a developing story after an as-yet unidentified hacker or hackers gained access to nude photos of a handful of celebrity women and published these on the web. As that investigation unfolds, especially into what appears to be a failure in the security of Apple's iCloud server, many of us non-celebrities are naturally wondering how safe our information is. But odds are we're probably still underestimating just how dangerous it can be to become the target of a hacker with the right skills and too much time on his hands. The lines between hacking, identity theft, and stalking can get blurry rather fast, and my guest on today's podcast has some insightful first-hand experience with that very frightening reality. This song is called No Promises, and it's being sung by Leandra Ram. It's about her experience in her early 20s when her life and career were derailed by a cyberstalker operating halfway around the world in Singapore. It was about 10 years ago. Leandra was an aspiring opera singer living and working in New York City, her career just taking off, when she appeared on CNN with Anderson Cooper to talk about her origins from the Genius Sperm Bank. A Singaporean named Colin Mac Yu Lung saw the broadcast on CNN International, and from that moment on, he made Leandra one of what turned out to be his many projects in stalking, harassment, and threats of violence. The experience cost Leandra several professional opportunities, made her terrified for her safety, and left her in a continued state of anxiety. Pressing a case of international cyberstalking is extremely difficult because laws vary nation to nation, and some countries have no cyberstalking laws of any kind. Nevertheless, Leandra pursued her stalker aggressively, along with the help of digital forensics examiner A.J. Fardella, and as of last December, Mr. Lung is serving a 3-year sentence as the first person ever convicted in a case involving cyberstalking across borders. Leandra also wrote a book about her experience called Stalking a Diva in collaboration with attorney Lisa Della Rocca. Today, these two women, along with Mr. Fardella, represent the founding members of the Alliance Against Cybercrime, a new organization designed to address stalking and other forms of internet-based crime through international advocacy, policy initiatives, and public outreach. Leandra's case and this new alliance were instrumental in helping to pass Singapore's Protection from Harassment Act in March 2014. I'm also happy to report that Leandra's singing career resumed after her ordeal. She continues to work in a wide range of genres, both recording and performing live. Leandra, thank you very much for joining me today. I read your story in Newsweek just this past week, and it's an incredible story. If I can encapsulate and tell me where I'm wrong, you grew up with music as part of your childhood, discovered opera as a teenager, and a love of opera, I should say, and in your 20s that found you in New York as a mezzo-soprano, an aspiring singer, working in opera. And as I understand it, what sort of began as a contact from somebody posing to be someone who could help you with your career turns out to be somebody quite dangerous. And this took up almost your entire 20s. Please, jump in and
that's correct so far. Perfectly correct.
But so tell me a little bit, though, about what did happen.
Yeah, that was a great description. Basically, I started singing opera when I was about 14. I was involved with music my whole life. And I started seriously pursuing classical music at that time. And when I was about 20, I was starting to really have a promising career, and I was still very, very young, obviously, but on top of my opera studies, it just so happened that I was asked to be on Anderson Cooper 360 on CNN to talk about my origins from the Genius Sperm Bank. So I figured that this would be a great media exposure for me. I might as well tell the world who I am and talk about this subject that I had no issues talking about, which were my origins from this repository. But what happened was it aired internationally, and that's what caused the attention of a cyber stalker who happened to live in Singapore. And it was kind of a perfect storm because this was at the end of 2005. The internet was still not 100% what it is today. The social media was still at the very newborn stages. Mm-hmm. And I was still so young. I didn't have a manager or anything yet to protect me. And I was just starting to get into a whole bunch of young artists and apprentice programs with different opera companies. I was just about to start my first professional engagement with the Sarasota Opera as an apprentice. And all at the same time, I had this crazy cyber stalker contact me out of the blue. I obviously had no idea he was a stalker. It seemed right in line with everything else that was going on in my life when he introduced himself as the music director of the Singapore Music Festival. Mm. And I was getting many inquiries at that time about performing, and so it seemed like just another one. And it wasn't until later on that I realized who he really was.
And my understanding is that tell me, I don't want to skip ahead. Tell me at what point did you know that it was a transition from somebody who was, I guess my question is two part, you know, first from somebody who was not who he was pretending to be. And then was there sort of a second moment of realization when it was, you know, this guy isn't just sort of some benign nut, but is, you know, legitimately dangerous?
Yeah, so that took about a year. So he first contacted me. The CNN interview was November 2005. Mm-hmm. He contacted me around December. And I sent him my resume, my headshot, my demo reel, like I would for anyone inquiring about me performing. And it took a little bit of time before I realized that he was a fraud, because first he kept on mentioning all these other avenues and these other venues for me to perform. So he kept on diverting my attention. So the Singapore Music Festival kind of fell through. It fell to the background. He kept saying that they're not interested at this time, or it doesn't seem like it's going to work out. But why don't you submit to this festival in Vienna, or this sing for my friend who owns a violin shop in New York? And so when he started diverting my attention, I knew, okay, he's not who he says he is. He also claimed that he was a sponsor of the arts, and all of these other venues that he kept on directing me to kept on falling through. And it took a couple times, and then I realized, okay, this guy is really just some crazy fan or something. But I knew that he wasn't the director of the Singapore Music Festival. And then that, I don't know exactly the time frame, but that was maybe about 1-2 months after first contact. But then it took a whole year before I really got scared and realized that this is not just somebody I want to ignore, but this is somebody who could potentially be a stalker. Mm-hmm. He kept on contacting me. He wouldn't leave me alone. And he kept on mentioning all these different festivals, and everything just kept falling through. And I just knew that this wasn't right. So you're definitely right in the way you explained it, that I did have two moments of realization. The first one was just, this guy's not who he says he is. And the second one is, this guy could potentially be dangerous or a stalker.
Right.
So at the end of that first year, it was actually December of 2006, I guess it was. It took about a whole year before I finally decided to do something, because ignoring him wasn't working.
And I understand that it escalated to the point where I know from one of the news stories I watched that a letter came to your parents' house. Is that right? A physical letter.
Right.
And then he also was making threats against opera companies, not only threats against you and people you knew, but also even against opera companies you were presumably either working with or auditioning for. Is that right?
Right. So that happened later. So this first year was really just him being annoying and and showing me that he wasn't who he was, who he said he was. And by the end of that first year, it got so annoying and so potentially bad. Like, I kept seeing all these red flags that I knew I had to do something to get him out of my life. I wouldn't call him a full-blown stalker yet. He really didn't do anything threatening until at this point where my boyfriend at the time sent him a cease and desist letter, which said, please leave her alone. We don't want anything to do with you anymore. You're obviously not who you say you are. You're not a sponsor of the arts. You're not the director of the Singapore Music Festival. Please leave her alone. And I was a little bit scared to do it myself, so I had the boyfriend write on my behalf. Once he got that is when he totally changed and became a full-blown stalker. And that's when everything you just mentioned started. He started the emails where he carbon copied 50 or more people, and these were all directors, conductors, music producers, people that he just found online that were either connected with me or just major opera entertainment industry people that he could find. And he sent letters to my home. And it went on and on and on, and it got worse and worse. And that's when the stalking really started, and it became a full-blown nightmare.
Mm. So what I hear you saying is that when you confronted him was when it first ramped up.
Exactly.
And I think, you know, I'm guessing anyway that as, and we'll talk about this further, but, you know, this is such a relatively new subject that we're only just beginning to grapple with, this question of cyber stalking and what is cyber stalking. And it's part of why I ask you about those sort of transitional moments, because I'm, you know, if you look at the statistics, almost everybody's been victim of a troll, if you will. Mm-hmm. You know, we all encounter that on a regular basis, I think, if you're out there on the web at all. But to be able to, I'm guessing that as part of your advocacy going forward, that it's what's helpful is to try to find ways to help other people identify when has something crossed the line? When is that moment that something goes from, you know, common garden variety troll, if you will, to, you know, to annoying, to, as you say, full-blown stalker.
Right. I definitely think that in my case, it was definitely a sudden shift. And I think the unfortunate situation is that as soon as he caught his eye on me, I was doomed. As soon as he happened to watch that Anderson Cooper thing, he was attached to me like a bee is to honey. And I think it just so happened that the cease and desist letter made that happen quicker. But I think the transition of him going into stalker was inevitable. Right. Yeah.
Yeah, no, and I mean, of course, that goes to the idea that, of course, you can't ever know who, you know, when somebody starts off being annoying, is this person, you know, about to go to that next step? I guess until they do.
Right.
But let me go back a moment because, you know, this as I understand it, this period, and I think people glancing at the story would find this surprising that a guy in Singapore using electronic media and communications can really, really damage and did damage your career for almost a decade in opera.
Right. It was really amazing that he was on the other side of the world because it seemed that he was right next door. And nobody receiving the emails would assume he was in Singapore. You would just assume he's a guy here. He has perfect English. I could just give you some examples of what he did. He used identity theft. So he actually got me taken off of my opera manager's roster. This was a very prestigious management company. And this stalker created a fake email address. Mm. And from this fake email address, he contacted the management and pretending he was me, said I no longer wanted to be on the roster. I'm taking my career in a different direction. He signed it as me. the management believed it was legitimate, and I didn't know until I went on the management's website one day and noticed my name was no longer there. I called them and I said, I'm just wondering why I'm no longer on the website. And they said, you resigned. You said you didn't want to be with us anymore. And I said, nope, that wasn't me. I didn't send that email. there was countless of other emails that he sent to other individuals pretending he was me. And that was something that was really hurtful because, you know, anyone can create an email. I can create an email saying I'm Sue Smith and I can pretend I'm that person. And people don't realize that it may not be legitimate. I might not be Sue Smith, you know, so he used that tool against me a lot. He created these blogs. The most notorious was called Divas Gone Wild. So when you Googled me, all you saw was this blog that had pictures of me that he distorted. He called me all these horrible names. He used defamation and slander. He pretended that there was a bunch of different critics commenting on my voice quality and giving me bad reviews. Of course, it was all him, but he used all these different names and aliases, so it looked like a lot of people were bashing my singing. He would write comments on YouTube. He created a Facebook hate group, a Twitter hate group. He sent death threats in the mail. Every time that I was performing with an opera company, every single person on the staff and on the cast list that was publicly available online, he would contact. So let's say I was performing in a role. He would go on the website, find out who my co-cast members were. He would Google them, go on their website, find their contact information, go to the contact list of the opera company, and he would carbon copy these threatening emails to everybody listed, and he would state that if I'm not fired from the performance, that he would show up with a gun and he would shoot me in the actual performance. So I remember one time I was singing with Toledo Opera. They were so scared, and legitimately so, that they actually had policemen standing outside of the performance. It was an 8 o'clock matinee. I mean, an 8 o'clock evening performance, and they had policemen standing outside. And of course, I couldn't focus on my performance. I couldn't focus on my singing. I was so distracted and embarrassed. And of course, nothing happened because he's in Singapore. But how would you know that when you're getting these threatening emails? You have to take them seriously. Right. And the internet is really one world. So these international borders don't really exist on the internet. And that's the main problem.
Well, and to that point, I mean, there are cases, unfortunately, where even the initial, even people who are just being loudmouths and have no intention of doing anything, we saw it in the UK, their public, you know, assault on somebody verbally, is then taken up by somebody else. Sometimes, and we've seen actual physical attacks on people that were inspired by, say, another troll. So not only can you not know that he's in Singapore at any given moment, but you also can't know that he doesn't inspire somebody else to take action who is in Toledo or anywhere else. It makes you long for the days when people with too much time on their hands just sent a bunch of pizzas to somebody's house. But it sounds also like you're describing somebody with a significant amount, you know, maybe not super, you know, highly technical, but a fair bit of skill.
Definitely.
Because you mentioned that he, you know, that if I had Googled your name at the time, that the first thing that would have come up would have been his site.
Right.
Divas Gone Wild, you said, and you know, and that plus some of the other things you mentioned. I mean, it sounds like not only did he have an unfortunate volume of time on his hands, but also you know, a fairly high degree of technical skill to pull all that off.
Right, and I think a lot of stalkers do, actually, cyber stalkers. That is, I just heard of another case of another woman. And it was the same kind of situation. And I hear this a lot, especially with my organization, the Alliance Against Cybercrime.
Yep.
When I speak to other victims, a lot of them are being stalked by people that have went to college and have degrees maybe in computer engineering or know very savvy ways to use the computer to their to destruct another person. Mm-hmm. So yeah, that's actually a very common thing that I've noticed.
Yeah, no, I think it is, as far as my perception as well. And it makes me want to jump to the question of what you're finding now. I was going to ask this at the end, but in terms of general response to your you know, making this public, to talking about it, to the Alliance, we've seen plenty of cases out there where people, you know, even casually criticized the technology itself, and people get rather, somebody gets rather violently upset about that. So I'm wondering whether or not you're finding criticism or support or both at this point.
Regarding my case or regarding
being, you know, a public advocate against this kind of stalking, are you finding anybody still continuing to criticize you for saying it?
I find that the general response is that people agree that there is a lack of regulation on the internet. Mm-hmm. And especially when I explain my case and I explain why there are so few laws out there, I think most people agree with me. I mean, obviously, everyone's going to have their opinion, but I feel like the majority of people realize that the internet is very new. We have not caught up with it. And it's not regulated at all.
Right.
We don't have identity protection. Anyone can say whatever they want. There's not a strong enough line between freedom of speech and slander. Mm-hmm. And because people are allowed to say whatever they want on the internet because of free speech, a lot of people can get hurt by that. A lot of teenagers have committed suicide because of cyber stalking. And I think that there's a lot that we need to catch up with. And we're definitely not at all there yet. There's so much on the internet that needs to be tamed, if you will.
Yes, no, and I agree. I was wondering if, I mean, but for example, you're not going out on Twitter right now and encountering attacks as a result of your coming forward about the initial problem.
Luckily, no.
Okay, good. And no, that's good to hear. Because
I think I had enough for one lifetime.
Absolutely, no. So. There's no question. And you know, I mean, it brings to mind immediately, you know, the I guess it's the obvious irony, which is that, you know, you're doing as a young artist, doing everything you're supposed to do according to the sort of the promise of the internet, which is, you know, putting yourself out there, using these tools to make yourself known, to make your voice known, your work known. And of course, in doing that, it also makes you, anybody, it makes you vulnerable.
Right.
You know, and so it does make me wonder even now. I mean, I see, you know, as I would expect, you have a wide internet presence. Your music is on most of the major channels, and you've got videos up there, and your own website, and of course Facebook and Twitter. You know, how did you feel sort of branching out into all that for your own marketing purposes? Do you feel any differently about it as a result of this experience?
I definitely have a lot of tools now, and I know that if anyone tried again, I have so many private investigators, lawyers, FBI agents that could get it stopped in 1 second. Mm-hmm. So because I have all those tools, I guess I really wasn't afraid of going back out there. Mm-hmm. I throughout this whole case, I developed so many contacts, and I really put my career on hold for about almost a year. Back in 2010, 2011, when I was trying to come up with a solution to this case. And when I was doing that, I went to the United Nations, I went to all the embassies, and during that, I developed all of these resources that I really have on my side now. So I guess because of that, I pretty much was okay with going back out there on the internet. I'm really just not scared anymore, and I wish I had these tools back then, because I mean, even though my original case was international, which makes it so much harder to prosecute at all,
right.
at least I know a lot more now than I did back then.
And, you know, since you brought all that up, you're something of an exception for taking action in the, at all, let alone sticking with it to the extent that you did. You mentioned the cross-border issue, and of course you're referring there to the fact that that laws are different nation for nation, and some nations don't have stalking laws at all. Right. And of course, cyber stalking is a new subject that even we in the United States have yet to quite figure out. Did you take the action to the extent that you did because you felt you had no choice, or was there more to it than that?
When I initially tried to solve my case, I went to the FBI. I was living in New York. I went to the New York Police Department, and I was told over and over again that there was nothing that they can do because of international borders. I spoke to the Singapore police. They also said there was nothing they could do, and I should speak to my American authorities. The American authorities told me to speak to the Singapore authorities. And my jaw basically opened every time that I was told this, because I couldn't believe, being an American citizen in 2000, whatever year it was, that this was allowed. And I kind of felt a calling to make a difference, because I just couldn't believe that this was okay, that somebody could send me a death threat, and just because he's from another country, that makes it okay and not punishable. And when I realized that this was happening and there was no international law for this is when I really became passionate of not only solving my own case, but of solving this problem worldwide. So I think it was really just living through it and becoming aware that there needs to be a law that I decided that I want to help. I have to do this.
And in your case, I understand is the first that involves an actual conviction, in a cross-border cyber-stalking incident.
Right. So what happened was, the stalking went on for many, many years. Fast forward to 2011, and with all my efforts and all of the help from everyone that I hired a man named AJ Fardella, who is a data forensic examiner. I co-wrote a book called Stalking a Diva. And I put all of my career on hold. I did everything I possibly could to find a solution to this. And in 2011, finally, the Singapore police took us seriously and they arrested him. And then fast forward to 2013, in December, is when he was actually convicted and sentenced to 3 years in jail. So between 2011 and 2013, he was on this probation. So basically, he was in jail for a few months, then released, and then he had to report to the police once a week. And he was not permitted to contact me until the trial happened. When the trial happened in December of 2013, he pled guilty right away. So I didn't actually have to fly to Singapore. My victim impact statement was read. The emails were read. And this was the first actual conviction, where he was sentenced to 3 years in jail. And shortly after that, in March of 2014, so just a few months ago, I helped pass the Protection from Harassment Law in Singapore, which is a new Singaporean law against harassment. So although it won't help international cases, it'll help other Singaporeans. If something like this happens again, they'll be more protected.
And do you know much about his story, his motivation, why he or anyone does this?
I think it's a case-by-case basis. Yeah. For my particular situation, I hired a private investigator who did a lot of background on this particular individual. He was somebody that was very intellectual. He went actually to Harvard and a couple other universities in the States before he was deported back to Singapore, because he was living here on an expired student visa. I think actually before that is when he served in the military in Singapore. And somewhere along the lines, my perception is that his intelligence got twisted, and maybe it was the private investigator believed it was maybe when he was in the military, but something happened. And he has quite a history of criminal activities. He stalked a woman at Harvard. I've gotten countless emails from other women that were at the schools that he attended that stated that they were harassed and stalked by him as well. In the actual court case, there were other women that they found on his computer that he was stalking. So I think that it really just depends. I think these are people that are not well. And I think that each person, each stalker has their own story, their own situation of why they ended up being this way. But I know with the one that I had, I think his mind just wasn't working well. And he must have been a very unhappy, depressed person with a lot of time on his hands. And I guess he saw pleasure in the demise of someone else. So I think the internet can be a happy hunting ground for people like that who really have no other outlet and are not happy in their own lives.
Right. And in terms of effect on your career, I have a specific question that you may or may not want to discuss. My wife's parents are opera singers, and so I know a little bit about the universe. And from what I understand, the sort of window of opportunity for an opera singer is pretty short. You sort of get, a shot at certain points or at a certain point, and then if it doesn't kind of happen, there isn't time to sort of do it again later in life. Is that true, and is that something is it true, and B, is it something that you feel was sort of irreparably damaged by this experience?
I think that the way it happened for me is that I naturally moved on, and this whole experience kind of shaped who I was and shaped my ideas and motivations. And I really wasn't inspired after this to go on and have a professional operatic solo career where I'm traveling from country to country and place to place. Who knows, maybe if I really had that passion and I wanted to do it again, I could have. I don't know. But I just didn't really feel it anymore after this whole experience. I kind of got changed by it, and my musical tastes changed and everything. I mean, it's such a life-changing experience that I grew with it. I morphed with it. And so it's really a hard question to answer, because I never really tried again, like on this super duper professional operatic level,
Okay. That's interesting.
So, I'm still singing and performing, but changed a bit, changed genres a bit, and changed my priorities.
Right. So the experience changed your own, changed you internally, and including your relationship to music.
Right.
And tell me a bit about your music now, what you're working on. I mean, I've sampled a handful of things, and it's a pretty diverse range of work.
Thank you. Well, I actually am pretty settled now in the San Francisco area. I've got married recently, and I'm actually expecting my first child.
Oh, congratulations.
Thank you. So, I'm pretty much here in the Bay Area. I will be singing with the San Francisco Symphony as a professional chorister. Mm-hmm. So I'm really excited about that. I'm going to be doing that pretty much full time. So that's kind of where my live performance focus will be on. And then I've recorded songs. I continue to record songs with different labels and also independently. And I just kind of have a more settled life now, if you will. Like, I'm not being the gypsy performer, so I'm pretty much here. Mm-hmm. And I'm excited about local performance opportunities.
That's fantastic. Are you writing as well, or recording other music written by other people, or?
Well, the latest song I recorded is called No Promises, mm-hmm. and it's actually based on this whole stalking experience, and I'm going to be shooting a music video with that, and that was actually written by other people. That was with a record label called Urban Tracks Records. I am writing still, but I have nothing planned at the moment that I'm currently writing or working on. But I will continue to have songs come out on iTunes and online.
Very good. Going back to the subject of cyberstalking, what is your assessment of where we are sort of culturally with this issue right now in terms of people's awareness? And what is it you would want people, you know, what are the one or two things you would really want people to start to think about differently in this context?
I think that this subject is getting a lot of attention, and I'm really glad that it is. Mm-hmm. The need for attention. There's a lot of cases, like I said earlier, a lot of teenagers that are being affected by this, a lot of bullying. And although I feel so bad for all the victims that are going through it, it's really making the public aware that we really need to make this a priority. I'm speaking actually next week at the Council of International Investigators annual conference, and I'm going to be speaking in front of a bunch of private investigators. And one of the key points that I want to reiterate to everyone is that cyberstalking is just as bad as physical stalking, and we have to make it a priority for authorities so that when a case comes in and someone shows you a death threat from an email, it's taken just as seriously as if someone says, I was just mugged on the street. You know, it's not any different. And I remember when I was going through my case, a lot of times I would get the response, oh, you're just getting emails, honey? Oh, just ignore it. That's nothing.
Right.
And I think in this day and age, emails are just as bad. There's no reason why it should be considered any less important. So I really want people to realize that it can affect your life so much. It can shape your life. We really need to make it a priority. And for the victims, I would tell them to go to your authorities as soon as you realize that this is not just an annoying troll or a spam thing that you can just ignore. When your gut tells you that this is a stalker, go to your authorities, make it known, hire a lawyer, find a pro bono lawyer if you can't afford it. Go to, there's so many organizations that exist now. Mine is the Alliance Against Cybercrime, but there's also many others that can help you and give guidance. And because the subject is getting a lot of attention now, I think people are much more willing to help. I think if my case would have started now rather than back in 2005, I probably could have gotten an answer and a conclusion much quicker, because we're much more advanced now in what we know. Mm-hmm. So I think that we eventually will be able to take control of the internet. It's just going to take some time. I'm working to try and get some treaties amended so that there is no border issue, and so that a treaty would cover if the victim or the stalker is in a different country. And I think that the federal law and the state laws will also be amended as time goes on, as more cases come up. Like, for example, the revenge porn thing that's happening right now.
Yep.
So many laws have been passed because we realize, well, there's another reason why we need to create new laws that hasn't been tamed yet. So I think we will catch up. It's just going to take a lot of time. And I think, like I said, if you're going through it, just continue to fight it and find people that will help.
Right. And to what extent are you seeing any kind of resistance? I mean, obviously, there's a fair bit of emphasis, if you will, on the value of anonymity among many, you know, what we'll call internet advocates, on the value of privacy. There's of course different aspects to that. There's fear of the authorities, rightly or wrongly placed. There's just a general, I don't know quite what to call it. You know, people who feel they need to be anonymous when they're, you know, using social media and whatnot. And of course, that then does breed a sensibility among some that, you know, I need my quote identity protected. And yet, to, you know, obviously the downside of that is that sometimes we're protecting the identity of somebody who's doing great harm, and means great harm. And so where are you seeing at this point that sort of that balance or that dialogue going?
Okay, well, the way I feel about identity on the internet is that that is definitely something that people use to their advantage. And because you can say whatever you want and not claim who you are, mm-hmm. people that are stalkers or that don't mean well can use that to hurt others. But at the same time, we don't have the resources nor the desire, if you will, to have everybody tagged, you know, like, oh, I have to use a fingerprint in order to create a Gmail account. No, you right. can say whatever you want. So that's something that we just really haven't been able to take under control yet, because there is that this major issue that there's people that will use it against them and people that will use it for them. So it's just not something that I think we have come to an answer on how to handle.
I would agree with that. So tell me a bit about the Alliance Against Cybercrime. It's a relatively new organization, but tell me, bring me up to speed and where it's going.
Sure. So I was speaking at Norwich University right when I was at the very end of my whole case. Mm-hmm. And I collaborated with a couple of students there who were very, very passionate about this. And along with my book co-author, Dee Rocha, and my data forensic examiner who solved my case, AJ Fardella, we all decided that why don't we create a nonprofit organization? We all have the same goals of we want to create laws and amend laws, and we also want to help other victims. So when I started speaking at colleges and talking to students that were going through this, we realized this is the best way to do it, is to just create an organization. So yeah, it is at the very beginning stages, but the first major milestone is the fact that I was able to help pass this law in Singapore, mm-hmm. The Protection from Harassment Act, which was right. a major milestone for me. That's yes. pretty much what I wanted this whole time, is to pass a law, and that was the first one. So that was such an amazing accomplishment. And like I said, next week we're speaking at a big conference where we're going to introduce the Alliance. And I've been speaking to victims really just by word of mouth, that people have know someone who knows someone who's going through this, and I give them ideas on how they can go about solving their case, because they a lot of times hit roadblocks and they have no idea what to do. And so I give them a lot of tools on how they can solve their case. So I'm really excited about the future of our organization, and I think that there's a lot of great things to come.
And how broad or narrow do you see the focus? Is your focus going to be almost entirely cyber stalking, or because of course crimes have a tendency to sort of overlap sometimes. Right. People who are involved in A are also involved in B.
The first project that we have is called the RAM Initiative. Mm-hmm. And that project, it was what we're still currently working on, which is focusing entirely on cyber stalking. But eventually we plan to branch out and reach other types of cybercrime that exists. But right now we're still so involved with this that it's really what our energy is placed on right now. But eventually we're going to have other types of cybercrime that we're going to address as well.
Very good. What have I not asked you that you want people to know, whether it's about your story or about the subject more broadly?
I'd like to say that the book that I co-wrote is called Stalking a Diva.
Yep.
And in this book, it's a very, very detailed story about my case. And it's written by a lawyer, actually, and me. And she very detailed wrote everything that happened from beginning to end. It took her hundreds of hours to mm-hmm. write this book. And It's a very, if I may say so, it's actually a really interesting read because it very much describes the internal workings of someone who's psychologically twisted, and it really makes you understand how this case came about and how it just snowballed into what it became and what we did to finally get him arrested and convicted and everything that happened from hearing from all the authorities, no, we can't help you, to, okay, he's going to be convicted and sentenced to 3 years in jail. So I just wanted everyone to be aware of that. If they're interested, I'd love to have them read my book. It's available on online, on Nook, on Kindle, iBooks. There's also a hard copy version that you can get from CreateSpace. And I think if you're further interested in this subject, I think it would really open your eyes to this case and others.
Thanks for listening to the Illusion of More podcast. To hear more music by Leandra Ram, you can find links at her website, leandraram.com.